You are listening to Sunday morning service at Unity of Tustin. Unity of Tustin is a mystical, spiritual community radiating light and love, transforming consciousness. Our mission is healing lives, building dreams, and realizing God. Now, Senior Minister, Reverend Carolyn Mathlin.
Good morning, and welcome to Unity of Tustin. As we begin our service today, let us join together in prayer. And so as our daily word invited us into, let us begin with prayer. Prayer for others. Prayer knowing and affirming that God is present in the situations and the lives of those that are on our heart today. The power and the presence of God moves through and as each one. Peace enfolds and surrounds us as we place our faith in the Christ essence and the power within others to heal and comfort and prosper. And in that same way, we also hold that consciousness for ourselves, knowing that God is in the midst of our lives. The power and the presence of the Holy Spirit moves through and as us, and we are lifted up and inspired and live from our Christed consciousness as we make decisions and choices that are grounded in our highest good. And so in that awareness, in celebration for this time together, we say, thank you, God. And so it is. Amen. So we are in the surrender experiment. How many of you are reading the book? Okay, great. How many of you already read it or are reading it? So most of you. If for those of you who haven't, I highly encourage you. This is for those of you who say, I just can't do another cognitive book, this is your book. Because it's filled with stories, beautiful stories, about what it looks like when we say, I'm open to releasing my inner resistance to outer circumstances. What if you align your personal will with what is arising and work from that place of willingness instead of in opposition to what is present? So it doesn't mean that we become a doormat. In fact, especially in this section, section four that we're in, there's some very clear actions that are taken that are in response to what's happening around him. In fact, he says, hey, you know, he writes in the book, I had heaven on earth here, and this isn't what my heaven on earth looks like. And yet there is enough willingness to not be in opposition to what is, but to work with it in a way that it ends up being even more beneficial to what's emerging. So there's this sense of when we say yes, when we allow our inner resistance to give way, or our preference, our attachment, our over-identification with our sense of self and what we like and what we don't like, when that begins to loosen, there is room for something else. We move from kind of this being this petty, small-minded person to a more mature and spiritually oriented soul. And that's a huge leap. That's the work. That's why it's an experiment, because we're experimenting with what will our life look like. And these beads are good reminders of that, you know, that you are experimenting, you're playing. So when we start looking at what does it prevent us from surrendering, from saying, no, this is, I won't do this, or I don't like this, so therefore I'm going to be in complete resistance to it, inner resistance, and therefore deny what's happening or be angry, project it out instead of looking at what might be stirring within me. Typically, when we are in resistance to surrender, we are over-identified with a preference or a belief or a thought or an emotional state. There's something in us that is constricted around a point of this is how reality is. And if reality affirms our preference, if reality affirms what we believe, then we're happy. If reality is saying this preference is, you know, getting challenged in some way, then what are we? Sad or mad or angry or one of those. We're acting out in some way, or we're inwardly acting out of this is not right. I don't like this, and therefore I am going to be mad about it. We are meaning-making machines. Our whole psychological world, our whole, you know, brain chemistry is set up to tell us what's pleasurable and what's not. When we are born, my dad was one of the first ones that loved computers. And so my first computer that I was so excited about came in a bag of parts or a box of parts. And one of the things that we got to do is that we built my own computer. Our brain, when we first come into the world, we have some babies hanging around on campus these days, comes kind of like that, unassembled. Have you ever seen a baby? They're just kind of taking it all in. You kind of wonder, well, what are you thinking in there? And the answer is they're not. There are no connections. And actually, from when they're born to about 3 years old, the brain is making 24 million connections per minute to be able to learn what it is, what it means to be a human. To connect, like when I want to move my hand, a signal from my brain goes down into my hand and it happens. We have to learn that. And it starts with the physical and it goes all the way into eventually the symbolic. You know, we see an object and then we create a meaning around it. Those are all these neural connections, these brain connections. And it's called myelination when this fatty tissue starts to connect different parts of the brain and strengthen certain connections. The more we reinforce a certain connection, the quicker it can happen. That's where some like reflexes come in. If you really work on your physical intelligence, you can start to develop a greater capacity to do things because you've really honed your skill on that. So from 0 to 3, this is really happening from 3 to 10 to, and then sometimes into 18, you're continuing to develop, but especially around the 10 to 18 time period into when we're 25. What happens is that our brain starts to go through a pruning process. And all of these connections, these 24 million connections per minute that our brain has created, start to get pruned. Some of them, if we haven't been using them, go away. And others of them, when those connections go away, others start to get strengthened. Depending on our orientation, how much spiritual practice we've done, how much inner work we've done, this can either solidify how we show up in the world as a very rigid, black and white, this is right, this is wrong, with no gray area, or it can start to be something as we do our work where we start to question, is this neural connection? Is this brain chemistry? Is this my pattern of behavior? Is this really serving me the best? And we can start to discern and make different choices. So this starts to play into our surrender experiment Because every day, 70% of the choices that we make change our brain. The brain that we wake up with in the morning is not the brain we go to bed with at night. 70% of our brain connections change every day. Why? Because our experiences change our brain. The choices that we make change literally our brain. What we focus on, our patterns, whether we meditate or not, literally change how we see and interact in the world. Because we are creating our reality with every experience. And we're creating the different circuits that are determining how we see the next point in time. And if we go directly back into the back of the brainstem and have more of a fight, flight, freeze response, or if our brain is connected with our neocortex and can start to see not only how we feel about it, what our mammalian or our reptilian response is, but what actually is happening. We have a capacity to see differently. The more we build up an ability to see and respond to the world from a place that is not so rooted in preference, that is not so rooted in this is what I like, therefore this is pleasurable, this is what I don't like, therefore this is not pleasurable. This has real-world implications for a lot of different reasons, one of which was from a study that in 2013 that they ran on what parts of the brain, this question of what we see has an emotional tone, and it reinforces whether we are happy or sad about it. So when we start looking at our preferences, because this whole surrender experiment is based on what if I don't believe my preferences to the point where it shapes my view of reality. So it's kind of good to pay attention to what your preferences are and what they're doing to your literal physical brain, your physical chemistry. Because the more you believe that if something happens that I like and I'll be happy and it'll be good, the more you believe that that's true, the more you're going to stay clinging to, well, if I just get everything I want, then my life will be okay. How many of you have gotten everything you want? First of all, that's kind of the impossible dream, right? Trying. Good luck. And when that's not worked, then come back. Because we need to shift our orientation to what do we actually want. If it's stuff based in the world, based on your preferences, you are setting yourself up for a pleasure-pain always experience. So, this study, for those of you who are watching the Super Bowl and you care who wins, this is particularly a warning to you. So they did this study of New York Yankee fans and Boston Red Sox fans. You already feel the fun coming? So they showed, because they were watching the brain and what parts of the brain get activated. So they showed it to pictures of both fans of the team players getting hurt on the field. Yankees players and Red Sox players. So when the Yankees fans saw their Yankee team members getting hurt, their brain, the part of their brain that feels empathy and compassion, lit up. Sadness, wanting to care, that got lit up. When they saw a Boston Red Sox player get hurt, can you imagine what part of their brain got activated? The part where their pleasure circuit is. Now you can say, who cares, it's just a game, but the reality is we extrapolate that into every aspect of our life if we don't pay attention. Because it's seeing someone or something out there as an it. And it doesn't matter if that is getting hurt because it reinforces my preference for my team to win. can look at this at country level. Us and them, as long as we're okay, then who cares? The level of caring shifts from a very small-minded my preference to a greater caring for humanity. And then you can go from there. This as an example of how our preferences literally fire in our brain. Our preferences can determine how happy or sad we are. So this is why meditation becomes really important, because there starts to create this gap between our identification with our preference as true and therefore creating either pleasure or pain, and an ability to witness what is actually arising. Because when we see someone hurt, for example, if we follow that theme, when you've done enough meditation, when you've done enough self-work, the first response is typically not, I'm glad they're hurt, right? Typically. It is, I hope they're okay, or deep concern, or caring, because we're first identifying with and seeing not an object for our entertainment, but an actual human being. And this goes for our spiritual, this goes for our spiritual leaders, our, you know, people out in the public eye. How often do we treat, as an aside, people, things as objects first? So there's a deep kind of sense of, instead of looking just at what are my preferences, what do I like, dislike, how is it, what am I orienting with here? What is your self-concept and therefore your concept of others that might be shaping how you are relating and interacting in the world that is literally affecting your brain? Because again, 70% of your brain connections change every day based on what you experience, the choices you make, the behaviors that you exhibit, how you show up in the world. And the more you focus on certain activities and patterns that are life-affirming, that are based in willingness and non-resistance, the less your preferences will start to dictate how tight and how small-minded you are in the world. So I want to look at, last week we looked at our great spiritual teacher, Moses, and looked at his some of his story and his pattern, and asked the question of, you know, those times in our lives when we've been the Moses who lashes out and kills and then runs, and then the times in our lives when we've been the Moses who gets the divine call or feels this real impulse to go back into a situation and show up differently, show up in a greater sense of self, a higher sense of self. So today I want to look at the life of Siddhartha Gautama, because he is one who, particularly as we start to tease apart and step and slip into more the surrender experiment in the context of looking at our self-concepts, and particularly our spiritual concepts of what it means to live a surrendered life, what it means to wake up, all of those things that we layer on, all of the preferences that we have for the world, we carry with a hefty bag on our back into our spiritual life. And we want to look and examine those as well, because they're going to set up this pleasure-pain response if they're not examined correctly. And they're actually going to keep us stuck from really, truly surrendering, from really, truly letting go of that inner resistance that that keeps us swirling in the stew. So Siddhartha Gautama was born in 563 BCE, before the Common Era, and he was born in the Nepal area toward what is present-day northern India. The legend is, he was born into a feudal kingdom ruler, and so the legend is that his father went when Siddhartha was a baby, took him to the holy men of the area. And they looked at him, and the holy men came back and said, this baby will either be a great political leader who unifies India or a great religious leader. Now, what do you think Dad wanted? So everything, again, our preferences shape, unchecked, our behaviors. Unconsciously. Doesn't mean we still don't have preferences, but if we're unconscious about them, we are constantly trying to either force our way over someone else so that we stay happy, and who cares about the others? So in this case, that's what Dad did. He totally insulated and isolated Siddhartha from anything that wasn't beautiful, young, pleasurable. He made sure when they went out into the common areas that there was no sign of strife or disease, so that his son knew nothing of life other than beauty and ease and grace, so that he would not feel compelled to search more, that he would be a great spirit, he would be a great political leader. So at 16, he gets married, he has a son, but then he starts to have this stirring of divine discontent. Some of us call it getting mad or getting depressed or not feeling like things are working out, but really, those are typically, we kind of put those outside of ourselves, but really what's typically happening in those cases is that there's some kind of stirring inside, a divine discontent that's saying something isn't right here. And so he would sneak out. He would find a way that he could get out of the family compound without his dad knowing. And he had four encounters that were meaningful and significant to him. The first one was that he went out and he saw an old man, bent over, hunched, and this was the first time he's ever seen someone old. And so he discovered in that moment old age. The second encounter was that when he went out, he saw a sick man on the street. And in that moment, he discovered disease. The third encounter, when he went out another time, was that he saw a funeral procession, and he saw a corpse, death, for the first time. So he discovered that we don't all just live forever and stay young forever. On the fourth, so now he's really like questioning his whole reality, right? On the fourth time out, he meets an old traveling monk who has this inner tranquility and this sense of at easement with the world. And clearly the monk has seen the world. And Siddhartha is just baffled and intrigued that someone who has not been sheltered from the world, because there was a false sense of that before from Siddhartha, but this monk has seen the world, has seen the suffering, has seen old age, has seen everything that comes along with being in death, and is still peaceful and tranquil and free. And from that encounter, Siddhartha says, I have to discover what this monk has. I must be liberated. And so he flees his life of privilege and pleasure to go discover what it's like to live free of these concepts of death, of illness, of even pleasure and gratification. And so in that, he hooks up with five guys who kind of, I think, become his followers. And they live this life of asceticism. And asceticism means that you basically give up any worldly pleasure. The religious life is filled with these teachings. In fact, Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, particularly Charles Fillmore, they were the co-founders of Unity, he in particular studied the yogic traditions that taught asceticism, that taught abstinence, that taught vegetarianism, as because this body was something to be denied and and to be transcended. There was an aspect of being tied to this body that felt like it was keeping him stuck in sense consciousness and race consciousness and human consciousness. And he wanted Christ. He wanted to wake up. So this is a teaching that it has a lot of spiritual tradition in it. And the Siddhartha was one of those who practiced that for a long time. And at one point, he got to the place where he was almost dead. And he saw in his vision a musical instrument. And what he saw was that when it was too tight, it would break. And if the string was too loose, it wouldn't play. And in the same way, he was guided through this vision that he was killing himself. He actually was stopping himself from being an instrument that could be used or that could attain its capacity, because he was starving himself. He was denying the instrument that he needed to actually attain what he was searching for, to find what he was looking for. So what he ended up doing was changing his spiritual concept of what it means to what you need to live an awakened life. And so what he did is he accepted from this young woman, who, that was a no-no too, to have to interact with the opposite sex, this bowl of rice milk every day as a way to sustain him as he sat under the Bodhi tree and attained enlightenment. Well, this did not fly with his followers, because his followers absolutely were from the perspective that you did not do that. If you did that, then you were no longer interested in attaining enlightenment. Do you hear how your spiritual concepts can start to block what might actually be coming forward? Your sense of what is right and what is wrong might be a little misshapen. The black and the white become gray, become nuanced and textured and colored. And so they leave him. And Siddhartha sits under the tree, receiving his food every day, and meditating, and eventually actually does wake up, does attain what he is searching for, that sense of freedom. Because in part, he was able to drop this self-concept of what it means to walk a spiritual path, what it means to, and what it takes to wake up, what it takes in our scenario to live a surrendered life. Because most likely you have some concepts of what it takes to live a surrendered life, right? How many of you have a concept of what it means? And most of the time, it's not pretty, right? It means you're going to have to sacrifice something, or you're going to have to do something you don't want to do. And those are all concepts. Those are all part of that, those 24 million connections per minute that we made as a baby, or that we are making now, that is defining, giving a sense of meaning to something that is made up. And instead, this week, as we continue in our surrender experiment, I'm going to invite you to start to look at your self-concepts. And you can start with the basics of, you know, the concept of who you are. You can look at it at a physical level, who you are in a role, who you are as in you know, your qualities. But eventually get to, who are you in your spiritual life? What are some of the spiritual concepts that you have? Like, what will it look like if you wake up? Because you have a concept. And typically what happens when we have those concepts, or when we project them out into other people, is that they become one-dimensional. Anyone ever notice that when you have an idea of someone who's really got it together, or who, you know, you think, well, you know, like if you look at some of the master teachers like Jesus or Buddha, there's a sense of, you know, there's a one-dimensionality to them. There's no texture. There's no nuance. It's just, oh, yeah, they're serene all the time. Or they're this all the time. They always do it this way. There's no texture or nuance. And the more we surrender our concepts in every way to what's real and what's alive, we become more permeable. We hijack that sense of like what's pleasurable and what's not in our brain and start to really be present to just what is. So this week, I invite you, encourage you to continue to practice meditation. On page 4, you have this in your bulletin as well. To continue to create the new neural brain connections, because what the brain that you wake up with is not the brain you go to bed with. So the more you practice some of these techniques, these tools, these practices that cultivate a more connected mind, a more spacious mind, the more capacity you'll have in that area, because you're actually building that connective tissue. So that's the first thing, continue to meditate. And then the next one is start to examine what your spiritual self concepts are. What are those? In the book toward the end of the chapter 4, or section 4, in that last chapter, he talks about these times of fire and purification in our life, these times of divine discontent that actually can release any self-concept that we might have that's keeping us stuck, that's keeping us like the Buddha that's almost dying. So I invite you to start to pay attention to what are some of the concepts that you're holding on to, that are deriving and giving you a sense of pleasure or pain. Yes, I like this. No, I don't like this. And then start to question or look at how are they serving your surrender experiment? And how are they perhaps a barrier to surrender for you? See what comes.
Unity of Tustin is supported through your generous tithes and love offerings. To support Unity of Tustin online, please click the donate button on our homepage. Thank you for listening.